And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
The race is on. The 2020 Formula One season continues to take shape, with the Azerbaijan, Singapore and Japanese Grand Prix now officially cancelled. But with plenty of circuits willing to take their place, there's still lots of room to manoeuvre to ensure there are at least 15 races this year. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me for chat on all things F1 are Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Scott, how are you? I hear you're thinking about a relatively early attendance to a race circuit.
I'm good, thank you. With all of the schedules now taking place for a few championships internationally and nationally, among all the excitement of Formula One getting its act together, the Porsche Carrera Cup Scandinavia has sort of has announced like a revised schedule, and the second round of the new schedule is the, I think they call it the Midnight Sun Race, which is in I've got to pronounce this right, Hvelefjord. In the north, and it's taking place in midweek, I believe. So it will be on the Wednesday afternoon and Wednesday evening before the Austrian Grand Prix. So I'm trying to work out if it's actually doable to go there and then get back. But that's the. Having experienced national racing in the UK, I'm well aware of the amount of travelling that sometimes you get sort of roped into to go from to the far-flung circuits. In Sweden, it's even more aggressive because it is a ridiculously long country.
I think you'd be wrong not to go.
Yeah, I would like to, but the thing is, Hvelefjord is very, very north in Scotland. I think I'm going to see
Scotland.
My geography is not great, but it's basically, I say Scotland, didn't I?
You did.
Sorry, yeah. So Hvelefjord is very, very north in Sweden. The reason I said Scotland is my geography is not great, and I always compare it sort of side by side with the UK because that sort of gives me a better reference. So where Stockholm is basically the just beyond the northernmost point of Scotland, and Hvelefjord is up by Iceland. Basically, it's like 800 kilometers or something to drive from Stockholm to Hvelefjord. It's like going from Brighton to Edinburgh, basically. So the sun basically barely sets there. I think it sets at 11:30 at night and rises again at 1 a.m., which is why it's called the Midnight Sun Race. So I'd love to go. It'd be really, really cool. But it is an absolute monster undertaking geographically. I don't think I'd get back in time for media day for the Austrian Grand Prix.
I'm now slightly suspicious about whether you really live in Sweden at all. Are you sure it's not some other country beginning with S? Swaziland or Sudan?
You introduced me as being in Scotland a few podcasts ago, Ed, so don't you start. You're as bad at this as I am.
Maybe I exposed an essential truth.
Maybe you've convinced me I'm actually in Scotland.
It's very, very, very possible. Also in far-flung northern reaches is Mark Hughes, and you've recently prevailed in a battle with your dog to see who would be the guest on this podcast, and I'm not entirely sure whether I'm happy with the outcome, actually.
Yeah, Baxter, he's a schnauzer poodle sort of amalgam. I was taking up residence in the room that I normally do the podcast from. So I've relocated just to keep him from interfering too much, because you can guarantee that if I sat down there, he wouldn't be content to play a passive role, let's say. So I've just left him resting, sleeping, and I've relocated to a different room.
You could argue that we'd actually add the level of insight if we had Baxter contributing, to be honest. We have had Gary Anderson's dog turn up on the Gary Anderson F1 show podcast occasionally, so it's not unprecedented.
Yeah, I mean, Baxter could... Baxter has got a speed gene. He is very much into going fast. I don't think there's much insight behind it. I think it's just joy.
That's exactly what dogs are for. It's kind of like a racing driver who's all commitment and no finesse, isn't it? Just you question the precision, but you can't doubt the enthusiasm. So that's what dogs are for. Moving off such canine-based topics, let's talk a bit about the calendar, Mark. We've lost Singapore, Suzuka and Baku. That's quite bad news, really, because they're three distinctive, challenging circuits, but it's not really a surprise to hear we've lost them. But those, which one are you going to miss the most?
As an event, probably Singapore. As a track, Suzuka and Baku's often crazy, unpredictable fun as well. But Singapore is a special event. And it being a nighttime race, by the time I've finished riding, the daylight's coming in through the media center windows. I'm sure you're very familiar with that. And walking back into those warm, muggy streets that have been a racetrack all the time that you've been there and were a racetrack last time you saw, and now coming out and it's just full of rush hour traffic, and there's bus stops, taxis, traffic lights. It's quite a surreal thing. But it's that's the one I'd miss the most. But street events like that and Baku are obviously the most challenging to organise at the moment. And you not only have difficulty of access, you know, putting up the grandstands and things like that during this time, but it's also, we don't know if it's going to be feasible to have mass gatherings there in time. So you have to organize these things much further out than you do for a permanent circuit. So yeah, Singapore and Baku, the casualties of that. Japan is saying the reason it's given is because it's not sure if the mass gathering restriction will be lifted in time, and also I think they've got they don't want to do anything which might compromise their hosting of the Olympics. So it's a very, very tricky situation. But as you say, there are plenty of other permanent venues stood in line waiting to take their place.
Yeah, well, Scott, obviously you followed this very closely, the story about the evolving calendar, so you'll have a little bit of insight on what's going to take shape. We know there's some European venues that could be added. We know there's some double headers that could be added. So right now, what do you think are the leading candidates to take their place?
So I reckon what we're going to have is, we've had this 8-race European schedule confirmed already. I'm expecting 2 races in Europe, an extra 2 races in Europe at least. And then I think, obviously, Russia comes into that equation, but I'm just waiting exactly to see sort of what happens with Sochi. So the way I see it playing out is 2 extra races in sort of Central Europe, maybe 1 at Hockenheim, 1 at Mugello, or 2 at Hockenheim. I would imagine, based on simplicity, logistics, etc., F1 would be quite keen to have 2 races in the same venue. So maybe, I reckon, 10 races on that schedule plus whatever Russia does, whether that's 1 or 2 races at Sochi, and then 1 or 2 races across each of China, Bahrain and Abu Dhabi. I think that will probably be the run-in. I think we'll end up skipping the Americas completely. And I think Vietnam will shuffle to next year, just delay its inaugural race to avoid having 2 Hanoi events in the space of 6 months. I think that covers off the rest of the run-in. I think we just got to the point where it's now very realistic to have between 15 and 18 races, because we're sacrificing variety for the sake of pragmatism.
And the doubleheaders also aid that, because it means you get 2 for the price of 1 if you can get somewhere. But it's interesting that America's leg, obviously there's 3 races, Austin, Mexico and Brazil in the Americas. Brazil looks extremely dubious. Mark, what do you think about the chance of Mexico and the USA? Because it's kind of a movable situation.
It is, yeah. And Mexico has already put out a statement saying, as far as they're concerned, they're ready to host the event, as per already announced. I think the whole thing will hinge upon what happens in the States. And if they think that the restrictions on crowd gatherings will be eased in time. I'm hearing that Austin actually does come back onto the radar. Austin can only happen if there are paying people there. The way the race is structured and funded, it can only happen if it's a normal, a conventional Grand Prix, let's say. And the thinking is that as things stand today, the restrictions on a crowd gathering may well be eased in time to make that event viable. And if that becomes viable, then Mexico becomes viable as well, because otherwise you're going over just for one race. So yes, but it's a very big question mark beside it, of course, because the situation is changing all the time in terms of what the R rate of the virus is doing and how they're going to have to adjust to how that evolves. Quite a lot that could happen between now and November, but I agree with Scott. It's probably, if you had to put some money down now and say what shape will the calendar be, I agree that it probably most likely won't have an America's leg, but it's not off the radar completely.
And Brazil is interesting as well, because while there's a general feeling that going there wouldn't be a very good idea given the situation there, the race organisers, they made a statement recently saying that if the race were cancelled on the F1 side, then there's a kind of penalty, financial penalty attached to that, even though it's a free race. So obviously there's a little bit going on there with regards to the question of who does the cancelling, etc. And that's going to be an interesting one to follow, because I'm not sure we can rely on the Brazilian government under the current regime to be doing the sensible thing on that one. So that could create a bit of an added complication for F1. But yeah, I mean, it's a real shame of losing the circuits we've lost and losing Interlagos, but it's the same thing as with the crowdless Grand Prix. Yeah, it's a shame, but it's either you have what you can have or you don't have anything. So, you know, it seems to be a fairly simple decision to make, and F1's done a good job to get this kind of calendar together. Scott, we should talk about Bahrain, because that circuit actually has five approved suitable circuit configurations for F1. Ross Brawn recently suggested using the outer circuit configuration, which you could, I guess, generously describe as a pseudo oval. I mean, it's not an oval, but it's sort of a perimeter circuit, for want of a better word, and suggests that's under consideration. Do you think that's realistic?
I think it's a nice idea. I think it's realistic. I just don't think it will happen, because Ross also sort of mentioned that there are other factors involved with changing the configurations, and you'd only have a few days to do it. So you'd have to completely change the infrastructure that you have in place for timing, for example, was one of the examples that Brawn gave. I don't know how big an undertaking that is, so whether that's actually doable within a couple of days, I'm not entirely sure. But if you look at we did a piece on the race, which showed what that pseudo oval looks like. There were quite a few flippant replies to that story, basically saying that Ross needs to have some geometry lessons if he thinks that that's an oval. But he, to be fair to him, what he actually said was there's a nice sort of almost oval track. So that is as much of a qualification of calling something an oval as he could possibly have done. The reason he mentioned it, it's sort of like the old like ring like circuits. So it's basically you go up towards what is, I think, officially turn four. So the long straight up to where Vettel spun fighting with Hamilton last year. And then when you go right out of turn four, instead of diving down into the sweeps down to the hairpin, you flick left, and there's sort of like a couple of like S bends that run all the way around the outer perimeter of the circuit, a flat out right kink that you rejoin where the penultimate corner is on the Grand Prix track. So that long right hander that then becomes the straight down towards the final corner. So that's where the track rejoins. So then you'd be hurtling down to the final corner at some rate of knots. And I think it's 9 or 10 proper corners on that track. So Ross is right. That would be loads of fun. It's a grade one circuit, so you'd be able to do it. But I think Bahrain would be quite keen to have something cool and different to to show off as a second race. But it's the sort of thing where it'd be a very short lap. It would be interesting to see whether the cars could hold up to the challenge, because it would be a really fast lap as well. Plus there are going to be other logistical issues around sort of making sure everything's in place and can be moved in the space of 2 or 3 days. So it might be that they just think it's more hassle than it's worth.
It looks like a really fun circuit, and it would seem logical to make use of the fact Bahrain has multiple configurations. I mean, that would be an extreme circuit, but of course as well, Mark, I think it's the endurance circuit it's called. That was used for the Grand Prix in 2010, wasn't it? It wasn't a particularly memorable Grand Prix, admittedly, although that was partly because it was the first race after refueling was banned again. So there was a certain amount of conservatism going on. But it would seem at least they should be using that one for an alternative, provided they can get around the timing challenges, just to create some variety in the doubleheader, given that they've got the circuits approved. Because that's the problem with most tracks. There are alternative configurations for all sorts of circuits, but very few of them have the necessary F1 approvals, and that's quite a complicated, in some ways costly process. So Bahrain could host three Grand Prix, a triple header on three different circuits if it wanted to.
Yeah, and we did use that track in 2010, not the one Scott was talking about, not the pseudo oval, but the hybrid of those, the normal track and that one where you turn left out after turn four and go through that little loop. I remember it was very unpopular with the teams and the drivers. It was very bumpy. It was causing all sorts of problems. But you know, needs must, and you do need to differentiate between these two, the double headers, as much as possible. And we will have had several double headers already by that time if all goes according to plan. And so if they turn out to be too similar, so that in a few weeks' time you can't remember which one, what happened on which one of the two Austria races or the two Silverstone races, there might be a bit more impetus to do something different. I know we got slightly different tyre compounds in the two Silverstone races, but something a bit more fundamental than that, there may be a bit of pressure to act upon whatever transpires at those earlier doubleheaders. So yes, I can see the logic of it, and I think really, as in all these things, I think everybody is keen just to make it work as well as it possibly can, and I don't think really that there's going to be any of the usual opposing politics about various decisions. I think everybody from teams, governing body, Liberty, TV companies, everybody is trying to make this work in a spirit of cooperation. And I think if it's generally agreed that we need to do something to differentiate the double headers a bit more, then if it's logistically possible, it will happen.
I was going to say that the point Mark makes about distinguishing between the races is really important, because back in my Formula E reporting days, that was always the frustrating thing about their doubleheaders, which were literally one on Saturday, one on Sunday, because they both had the same name. So for London, for example, it was just London E-Prix 1 and London E-Prix 2. And it was like, well, so like, you need to be, the races need to have individual significance, and it won't be enough really to just do what we've done for Austria and Silverstone, where you've got the Austrian and Styrian Grand Prix, and then you've got the British and the 70th anniversary Grand Prix. Like, when it comes down to it, months down the line or years down the line, you're not going to remember it as that, and people will be muddling up, was that Silverstone 1 or Silverstone 2, like in their head. You need something that's going to properly distinguish it. And but for Bahrain, I don't think you'd ever go down this route, because I think it would probably be crazy. But Bahrain, you've also got the option, I suppose, of a daytime or a race or something like that. I don't know what the climate is actually like for Bahrain in November, if that's more realistic than it is at its normal time of year, should we say. But they've got to do something. And what they've done for Silverstone, where they've slightly tweaked the compound range, so that I think it's the second race has a one step softer set of compounds, like, that's just not enough. I appreciate the effort, and maybe it will mix things up a little bit, but there needs to be something different. We've got a unique situation for the 2020 season, and if the pragmatic way of ensuring we've got a season is to have multiple races at the same venue, then there has to be a proper bit of creative thinking to distinguish between them.
I think holding a race in the daytime at Bahrain is perfectly realistic because they used to do it for a long time. Obviously, teams could argue that they won't have planned their cooling for it. But looking at a very, very brief glance at the average temperatures for November in Bahrain, doesn't look like it's ridiculously warm. Looks like it might be a bit cooler than it would have been for other races there. And I agree that, I mean, that's a really easy way at least to differentiate it, because at least then when you sort of picture the race in your mind, one will have darkness as a background, one will have light as a background. So that's one way of doing it. And of course, Abu Dhabi also has that option as well, because that's the kind of dusk race, isn't it? It's as night is falling, so that there's things that can be done there to differentiate them. But I think anything F1 can do to change things will be necessary. The one thing that is interesting is, although Mark, you're quite right about the spirit of cooperation and we're all in it together, but if, for example, that Bahrain question is up in the air about configurations, and we, let's say it's a few races into the season and you might start to get a season taking clearer shape and teams starting to be more aware of the kind of relative performance of their car in certain conditions, you might start to see a little bit of pushback if a team fighting for the championship were to think that one configuration or other might favour them. So I think once the shooting starts, so to speak, this year, there will surely be a little bit of that, because they can argue, well, we know we're going there, we know the race is going to happen, so you know we're within our rights to argue about the configuration. Can you see a little bit of that happening once we get into a proper fight?
Oh yeah, of course. It's like when you ask the teams to come together to come up with a set of regulations that they think would work in meeting an objective, and they all do that in a spirit of cooperation, and as soon as those regulations are announced, they're instantly, those same people are looking for ways around those rules that they've just made up. So yes, of course that'll happen. That's just competition, that's how it works. But whatever works, I think, as you were saying earlier on, I think we just have to go with and accept that we have something at all, to have a championship at all is going to be a fantastic result under the circumstances.
Yeah, that's very true. I'm quite interested to see if there are two Bahrains, what they call the second one, because there's no kind of historical names they can call on there, aren't they? I mean, Abu Dhabi, you could have a UAE Grand Prix, couldn't you? Because obviously it's in the UAE. Mm. But Bahrain isn't in the UAE, it's its own place. So that would be an interesting challenge to come up with a name. Scott looks like he's got a name.
I was just wondering if they, because it's Bahrain, isn't it, that has the gives the permission for the other races in that sort of region, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a Middle East Grand Prix.
That's what I was going to suggest, the Middle Eastern Grand Prix.
Yeah, that's a good question. Although, you never know, if they start running out of circuits, they could even go to some of the other Middle Eastern licensed circuits, like Dubai or Kuwait.
I was thinking Dubai was not an outrageous option, because it's there's the difference, isn't there? Within the Grade 1 circuits, there are the Grade 1 circuits by F1 designation and Grade 1 circuits that look like they might actually be able to host a Formula 1 race. And I would put Dubai in that category, definitely.
I haven't been to Dubai or Australia for quite some time, but yeah, it was certainly built with that possibility in mind. And it'd be quite an interesting circuit, actually. It's got a bit of undulation as well, Dubai, contrary to the perception of things as a bit flat in that area. So it could be interesting. But I guess F1's probably keeping those in its back pocket. So if in a worst-case scenario where basically no races can happen in that phase between the end of Europe and the Middle East races, then but remember when we had GP2 Asia, it could be a little bit like that. So we could have races in that region. Although GP2 Asia in the end went to Imola. So who knows what's gonna happen with that one. Make sense of that one. I won't get into the details of why that went on. But anyway, let's move a little bit on to on-track action, because we have seen a Formula One car on track in Anger, Mark. Mercedes did their two-day test last week at Silverstone with a two-year-old car. We saw various images and some video and bits and pieces, everyone in masks and social distancing and everything. What does that tell us about F1's new normal?
Well, yeah, that test was as much as about trying out the new covered protocols of running an F1 car on track from the garage and the operations point of view, as it was a test of a car. It was a two-year-old car. And it also gave Bottas and Hamilton a chance to get rid of any rustiness that might have formed during an enforced layoff, although Lewis was saying he didn't feel any. He felt absolutely as normal. So the discipline would have been to work on the car and get it fine-tuned to the specifics of the day and the track, and getting everyone back into the rhythm of their roles, but just as an exercise. And it was really about doing it within the new measures that teams are going to have to operate during the forthcoming Grand Prix. So I think it was lovely to hear that engine note going down the pit lane. And it's amazing how quickly that it sort of... it had become like a when I heard it, I was suddenly nostalgic, and it seems such a recent thing that we haven't had any racing, but all, when you hear that sound, there was just something that made me think, oh wow, that sounds great, that's fantastic, what is that? And just because we've been starved of it for these few months.
And you went through your Can-Am phase during the break of watching that, so that should have satisfied your need for noisy racing cars in that period.
yeah, they don't sound as good as Can-Am cars, but yeah, there you go.
I was once testing at Silverstone an MX-5 when a Can-Am car came past me just into cops, pulled right in front of me. Absolutely astonishing sound, brilliant to get that sort of view of it. Scott, you went through the FIA's quite lengthy document about restarting racing. So that's given us various clues about how it's going to work. What did you take from trawling your way through that document?
Yeah, thanks for reminding me of my highlight of the week. That was, I wouldn't say it was a labour of love. I would say that was a testament to commitment and obligation. It's a very long document, and there's going to be additional specific code of conducts for different championships, I think. Issued in the coming days or weeks. So basically the gist of that is largely what we know Formula One's going to do, because I think the FIA and Formula One's priority has been to get the season started. It's been the major project in terms of restarting major motorsport, certainly outside of America. So the F1 guidelines that have then been approved by national governments, it's understandable that these then form the basis of wider motorsport return. The FIA said that from the very beginning. So nothing sort of stand out in terms of new information, but a reiteration of the need for testing where possible of certain precautionary measures. So making sure that there are backup officials and stuff like this in case, for example, the clerk of the course or the race director or something tests positive for it and needs to be shuffled out. Do you then have everyone in place to then move up the chain, basically? Lots of specific details about marshalling, because I personally had quite a few messages from marshals basically saying, well, we've not been told anything, or there hasn't been any public information about this, because it was all being dealt with. So there are stipulations in place for marshals to basically act like the teams are going to act. So in the instance where you can't do your job while social distancing, you will basically have to operate in that cluster for the duration of the week. So it means small groups of marshals, like small groups of race teams and small groups of other officials, operating together. So staying in the same place, commuting together, only socializing with one another and not going and mixing with other groups, that sort of thing. On the racing side, one of the interesting suggestions was, if you can't do certain things within the schedule without breaking the rules, such as, for example, the grid build-up before a formation lap, which is a big part of a Formula One Grand Prix, but it's also things like British touring cars, where that's very, very common. Loads of guests on the grid, all the teams sort of mingling, personnel mingling, grid walks with TV, that sort of thing. Now, obviously, we know that that's going to be reduced massively anyway, because there won't be any guests in attendance for these closed events. But the suggestion was, if a championship still feels like it can't do that procedure safely, then why not maybe scrap that process entirely and just have formation laps starting from from the pit lane, from the team's garages. Now, as I understand it, that's not going to happen in Formula One. They're going to keep the grid procedure, but just probably in a slightly reduced capacity rather than everyone being out there, what is it, 20 minutes before the start of the race or half an hour before the start of the race? So that is probably going to change. We might see other championships, smaller championships, go that route because I guess there's less for them to lose by binning it off, basically. But it's just interesting, and it's really good as well to see that sort of stuff made public so that we can actually understand and appreciate the amount of effort that's gone into it. I think the documents in total are more than 18,000 words of safety protocols and guidance. And we know that it's to the highest level because it's been approved by, for example, the Austrian government. So I think it's very good. It will help a lot of other championships outside of Formula One get started again. But from a Formula One point of view, there's been so much information and so much talked about over the last few weeks. There's nothing's really changed on that front. It feels like it's been set for a while because that's the plan that's been formally presented.
And it's important to note what you said there, that all of these races, they have to get specific government permission for the provisions that are in place. So this isn't just a kind of, oh, we'll do all these sorts of things and a vague idea. It has to be a proper formulated plan that stands up to scrutiny, which is not a trivial thing to put together. And obviously, you know, Silverstone, for example, Stuart Pringle was interviewed on Radio 5 recently. He said they're still working on some of their little details and having to be willing to adapt and change as things shift about. So, it's going to be curious, though, isn't it? Some drivers have already talked about it. Lewis Hamilton said it's going to be strange, these ghost races that they're being called, because it's going to be even quieter than a test because there'll be no one in the grandstands. There'll be no fans or just anywhere. So it will be a bit like a ghost town, but it's going to be interesting to see what's like. Are you looking forward to seeing this slightly strange manifestation of F1, Mark?
I don't know if looking forward to it's the right word, because on the one hand, you'll feel sad for how different it is to normal, where everybody, you know, there and enjoying it and adding to the atmosphere. But it's better than no racing at all, and it gets us underway again. And yeah, so better than nothing, but I still look forward to the day when we get back to normal, obviously.
It's going to be particularly grating, given that we start off with a run of races that are massive fan festivals, really, aren't they? Austria, Silverstone, Hungary, Spa, Monza. These are hugely attended races, aren't they? And very, very popular. So that's going to be interesting to follow. One thing that's quite interesting is, obviously, you mentioned Hockenheim seems to be at the front of the queue for European races, but Mugello and Imola is the other one that have been mentioned. Which of those two circuits, the Italian ones, would you prefer? Because Mugello obviously has never held a World Championship Grand Prix. Imola, obviously a famous circuit. If you had a choice between those two, which would you go for? Scott, you can choose first.
I think it would be quite... I just think from a pure interested to see how it goes point of view, say Mugello.
Yep, interesting circuit to see. Mark, would you prefer just to go back to Imola?
They've each got their appeal. I mean, the Mugello, just because it's different, we haven't been there before, it's always interesting to try something new. But Imola is a beautiful place, a beautiful circuit, and I wouldn't be disappointed if it was that.
Simple enough. We'll go to all three of those extra European venues. Then that'll make it straightforward enough.
Should we just go on our own European tour as a podcast? Just like sod the F1 calendar and the schedule, and let's just go around a bunch of cool European F1 tracks.
Well, there'll be no lack of places we could go to. There's some very cool circuits with some of them World Championship history, some of them not. Scott, there has been some sort of F1 racing of the kind with George Russell, Williams driver, grabbing a few headlines lately in the virtual Grand Prix events. He clinched the unofficial title even before Sunday's finale in Montreal. So do you think we should care about that?
That's a very blunt way of putting it. I think it's been a nice filler, hasn't it, during the gap. There's been some proper engagement from some very entertaining guys. George and Charles Leclerc have been at the forefront of that, and they've taken it very seriously and put a lot of time and effort in. Some of the racing's been really good in it. It's been a little bit disappointing to see a couple of drivers sort of turn up for one race and then not come back, but I suppose that's just the nature of people's private lives and schedules and sort of whether you're really interested in playing that video game or not. Full marks to Pierre Gasly for committing to the virtual Le Mans 24 Hours and the virtual Canadian Grand Prix. A hell of a doubleheader. One of the beauties of esports is that you can race in these different championships, different continents on the same day. So that's been very good. But I am. What's been really good about the F1 virtual series is they've not really cared about being. They've not really been 100% determined to just do a faithful recreation of the real world. So I have actually enjoyed the fact that they've put some random VIPs in there, sports stars, as a football fan, seeing the likes of Sergio Aguero and Pierre Aubameyang turn up in Formula One races has been quite funny. And it's not detracted from the show because the level at the front of the field is so high and you've got the likes of Russell and Leclerc doing it. So I actually think that it's been quite a nice little combination. There's not been any controversies like we had in IndyCar with drivers deliberately taking each other out. There's been a few mini controversies within that, but I just think it's been a very, very nice use of everybody's time, to be honest. And it's ending at the right moment as well, because I just feel like you're going to get... We had quite an early saturation of esports within this period, and the strongest championships have shone through, like the Virtual Grand Prix series, and you can call this tribal or not, but the all-star stuff from the race, especially the Legends Trophy, has just been a really enduring, popular, enjoyable element. But there's a risk that certain things like the F1 stuff would just sort of roll on a little bit too long. And I think they've picked a nice time to draw a line under it. So now everyone can look forward to the real season starting.
The thing I found interesting is when following these races, as well as watching the main feed, you can watch some of the drivers' Twitch feeds as well. So George Russell, Charles Leclerc, Lando Norris, loads of them, Louis Delachat, plenty of them have got a Twitch feed. So you can hear them and see their approach and that kind of thing. And the thing that's impressed me about Russell is he's taken it very, very seriously. And this kind of reflects a serious driver, because even though there's a certain lighthearted element to this series, which is in keeping with the game, because it's not a hardcore simulation, the F1 game. It's meant to be slightly more accessible than that. But I've been impressed to see Russell's approach to it. Obviously, he came in for the second race. I think the level that he needed to be at caught his attention. But he started well, but not brilliantly. And he's put a lot of effort into making sure that he's emerged as the leading driver. And, of course, won that unofficial title. And that, to me, I think, says a little bit about George Russell. I mean, what do you make, Mark, in general of Russell? Because we saw he had this, I think he had a very good season last year, a little bit unseen because the Williams was so uncompetitive and because there were question marks over Robert Kubica in the other car as the one valid benchmark. But there's a lot to be impressed about with George Russell, isn't there?
There is, and his whole approach is one of answering all the questions and being completely prepared. And I noticed even Charles Leclerc was saying how amazed he was, but at the level that Russell had got to in sim racing, and it's, as you say, it's a reflection of an attitude of an approach. And before he made his Grand Prix debut in Melbourne last year, he was talking about, because I'd been watching him out on track and the first couple of practices, it was as though he was just data gathering. It didn't really look like he was having a real attack of the place at all. And then come qualifying, he did full attack, and it was very impressive. And he'd said that was just his normal way of work. And then the same thing had happened when he went to Macau, and he said, in the practices, I wasn't in the top 10 in any of the practice sessions, and then I put it on pole. That I think is just his way of working, and I think it's a shame that the statuses of the drivers are sort of frozen as they were at the end of last year through losing these races, because with the Williams appearing to be able to at least mix it at the back of the field this year rather than being miles away from the next slowest car, as it was the case last year, I think we may have seen George have already put in some starring roles, particularly if they've been like a wet race or something like that. And I think his status would be much enhanced now through having this car that at least would enable him to fight. And I think there would already be he'd be a hotter property, I think. The general perception would be that he's a hotter property than his status at the moment, which is, yes, he's very good and, he's a potential Mercedes driver in the future and all that. But I think there might be a little bit more of a fever about him had the season already gone ahead as planned.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. He'd had the chance to test himself in proper races, should we say, because he spent a lot of last year almost driving about off the back rather than really, really racing professional as his approach was to it. But I think there's a very, very good driver in there, and both in terms of just the fundamental pace and the overall intelligence of the approach. And I thought he did very well last year to make the most of limited opportunities. He was never complaining about it. And I think I actually rated him as the best of the rookies last year, just because it was a really, in fact, between him, Norris and Albon was very, very close, I would say, in terms of the overall performance. They all did different levels of things impressively according to the level that they were able to race at, shall we say. So it's interesting because Russell is a factor in the Mercedes driver argument, shall we say. For one, I'm not sure there's necessarily an argument going on. Obviously, Hamilton and Bottas still aren't fully confirmed for next year. So perhaps Russell will have good reason to be a bit disappointed he hasn't had the chance to really press home his case for a promotion next year. But Scott, if you're in that situation of Mercedes, how would you be viewing Russell? Because obviously, down the road somewhere for Mercedes, there will be a point where they no longer have Lewis Hamilton, whether that's he suddenly decides to retire at the end of this contract, which seems very unlikely. You know, he's not going to be racing Formula One probably in 10 years' time, is he? So there needs to be a succession plan there, and they know what Bottas can do. They know what their hopes are for Russell. So that'll be kind of there in the back of the minds of the team, of Toto Wolff and everyone, as to exactly what the best way to progress Russell will be.
Yeah, it's not easy to work out exactly what the best option is. I guess the main hope will be that Williams gets its act together to the point where Russell can properly mix it in the midfield. Because I'd like to think that the team would be willing to do what Ferrari did with Charles Leclerc once the driver's sort of proven himself off of the very back of the field. I mean, I think it's fair to say that if Sauber hadn't made the progress it did through the 2018 season, that I don't think Leclerc would have got the Ferrari drive for 2019, because if they'd carried on where they were at the Australian Grand Prix in the first round, you know, I remember speaking to Fred Vasseur and he joked to me that they were racing the medical car into turn one. If they'd been at the back of the grid like Williams have been, then I just don't think Ferrari would have taken the punt, for want of a better word, on Leclerc. So if Russell can get to the point where he's mixing it for Q2 slots and maybe every now and again with a chance of sticking it in the top 10 on a Sunday, then I feel like Mercedes would go, yeah, do you know what? We've seen enough of him in our car. We've seen enough of him in the simulator. We know how quick he is. We know he can execute. He's a good racer. He's fixed his turn one weakness, if he's really got a turn one weakness or a start weakness. He's now ready. We're willing to take the punt on him. But I just think that Williams has been so far off that it's too big a step to go from comfortably the slowest car to a car capable of winning the title. There needs to be some kind of intermediate step. And that's the difficult thing. I'm not really sure where that intermediate step comes from, unless Mercedes is able to leverage something within Racing Point or Aston Martin from 2021, or McLaren, which will be a Mercedes customer team again, whether that's because Ricciardo leaves or because Norris gets snapped up by someone else. I don't know, but I feel like there needs to be an intermediate step before Mercedes is properly comfortable picking George.
Blimey, you're talking about Ricciardo leaving McLaren before he's even joined.
he's not even done a race in his second season at Renault. He's already moved to McLaren, and now I'm
now you've
about
got
him.
You've got
to
where's he
team.
Going? Where have you got him going after McLaren? Where's he off to?
I think he's just going to give up and go surfing.
Ah, okay.
No, I'm never going to get a drive at Ferrari. There's no point in trying. I'm off to bank my millions and enjoy the sun in Australia.
Right. Tim sorted out. But yeah, I take your point about that there needs to be an intermediate thing, and the way that Ferrari did it with Leclerc wouldn't necessarily be followed. And in fact, if you look back to how Ferrari were progressing Jules Bianchi's career before we lost him, he'd been in the Marussia, which was just, you couldn't really judge his ultimate level in a car that far off. And Ferrari had decided for the following year he was going to be in the Sauber for that very reason, to get a more realistic, data point, really. I would hope that the Williams this year, just the fact that it can be racing with those other cars, if it can, as it looked as though it could in testing, I think that would probably be enough.
Yeah, I think what you want to see is a driver in a situation where consistently tiny differences make a big difference. That's what Leclerc was able to do in his first season with Sauber, because that was, sometimes it was quite often a Q3 marginal car, and the difference between doing kind of an outstanding job and a very good job could be quite significant in terms of whether you get points or whether you make Q3. And that's a point where you can really show yourself well. And although the Williams isn't going to be probably at that level, if it is marginal, where tiny differences will get you into Q2 or get you a 10th place rather than a 12th place, that will help matters enormously. But I think it's difficult for a team like Mercedes, because there is a point where if you've got a driver there, and they'll be able to analyse huge amounts of data about Russell. He's been in the Mercedes F1 car. In fact, you notice when he does some of his practice stuff, when he twitches it for the virtual Grand Prix, he often puts himself in a Mercedes because he quite likes that idea. So they know what he's capable of. And I think you will have to, if you're making a decision as that team, think, actually, is there a point where we, even if we can't get an interim step, whether Williams doesn't quite provide it, and he is going to be at Williams next year if Mercedes don't change anything, or I can't get another team that was an interim step, there might come a point where Mercedes have to say, right, actually, if we think this is a guy who can be outstanding, because they know he's very, very good, we know that at the very least, but can he be outstanding? You might have to say, do you know what? We do need to get him in, but it's all connected to how long they think they'll have Lewis Hamilton for, etc. Because right now, unquestionably in the short term, Hamilton Bottas is the sensible approach to take. Obviously, you wouldn't not have Hamilton if you could have him, but Bottas is a great teammate and performing at a high level. So it's interesting. But I think Russell has a good idea of how good he is, and he knows where he needs to improve. And you mentioned the start. The first lap weakness, as it were. He's very aware of that. I like asking him about it just to be annoying. And he will say, partly in his defence, that sometimes he was being quite conservative last year, and it is difficult down the back because you've got 19 or 18 cars ahead of you disturbing the air. But he did accept that was an area he just needed to work on a little bit and was expected to this year. And I'm sure he will, because he's very good at picking the area to refine. Good approach, intelligent driver, and I think underpinning that is a lot of pace. So, interesting to see how he comes on. Now, with a due sense of dread, Scott, I am going to hand the floor over to you, because as you very occasionally deign to do, you've chosen not to neglect your people this week, haven't you?
Yeah, that's right. I just figured with the F1 season now starting to take shape, it was quite a good opportunity to sort of... To open the floor to our listeners and the readers of the website.
Has Scott's people got a theme tune yet?
I was kind of leaving that to you. I thought that you'd be quite good at coming up with something. You're musically talented, aren't you?
That can mean just about anything. But yeah, we should probably try and come up with a theme tune for Scott's people. But for now, we'll just have to have it, Scott's people. There you go. That's a start. Partridge-esque.
Very good. So basically, I was curious to know, given we're pretty confident there's going to be bonus European venues, and we know that Formula One is looking at alternative circuits or layouts rather for other races, for double headers, what track do our listeners and readers want to be the bonus European venue? And like the Bahrain Oval, which alternative layouts might you choose for the rest of the year, or alternative sort of tracks would you go to? And there was a very, very healthy response, ranging from the very pragmatic to the absolutely ridiculous. So I'm just basically going to pick these at random so that there's a nice mix. I was very surprised there were three different people, I think. Tom Spencer, Richard Randall, and someone else, I can't remember who, suggested Donington Park as a bonus European race. Tom Spencer mentioned it, basically just said it would be retribution for the way Formula One dumped the circuit and put its future in jeopardy. Which is obviously a not so. It's a very thinly veiled reference to the saga around the the Donington track and stealing the British Grand Prix. What would that have been now, like 12 years ago, 13 years ago, something like that? Yeah, it took the circuit to its knees, so it would be quite nice. But as I was saying, I think a bit greedy for the UK, considering we've got two races in at Silverstone. Freddie Coates, like a few other people, suggested Nürburgring. If you have a race at Hockenheim, could you then have another race at Nürburgring, or could you just have Nürburgring instead of Hockenheim? Freddie also suggested Magny-Cours, which I hadn't seen suggested by anybody else.
And can I endorse Magny-Cours? Because I
love
Magny-Cours. I think
you love it.
I think it's an underrated circuit, and I think modern cars would be very would work very well on it.
I concur with it. I think Magny-Cours was much maligned. I think it was just because people didn't like being in the middle of the countryside, away from the bright lights. It wasn't to do with the track itself, and I thought it was a great venue.
We talked about Imola early on, so Freddie, Tom, Gregory, Jake Nicol. Jake Jones, KGVE52, don't assume that's not their name, and Alex Davey all advocated Imola. And in fact, Alex said Imola every single time. So don't think we'd see a lot of overtakes, but he's just very keen to see what modern F1 cars would look like going around that track, which I think is something that quite a few people share. I will rattle off a few of the crazy ones who pretty much completely missed the point of the question, but I'm just going to put them in anyway. JL said Clermont-Ferrand. I'm up for it, but I think I can't imagine that's in any way realistic. John Fellingham said Estoril, purely because it was the bonus track on F1 97 on PS1. Fair.
Estoril's licensed.
Yeah,
could hold one.
And it's as good a track as good a reason as any to put one on the calendar. I had a couple of suggestions for Turkey being revived, but I think everyone would like to see Istanbul Park back on the calendar, as from a circuit point of view. I don't know what it was like to go there actually for a race.
Yeah, I
like going to it.
Okay, so that's fair. Had quite a lot of had a shout for a cheeky road race at Pescara.
We could call it the Jarno Trulli Grand Prix. So that's his part of the world.
Richard Randall, as well as suggesting Donington, advocated the return of the Birmingham Super Prix. San Sebastian Grand Prix hasn't been held since 1930, I think.
I'm all for visiting very, very retro races. Yeah,
time to bring it back. That was the suggestion of George O'Donnell. And then a few people advocating Silverstone somehow going back to the old Grand Prix layout. So my guess is that pre-2010 and using Bridge. I think they're quite keen for that.
That could be anything, because there have been about 1,000 different versions of that circuit.
Last year I went to the... I checked out the Silverstone Museum and went out around the back of it down onto the old circuit bridge corner. And the thing that was, first of all, I was really surprised actually being down there like on foot. I didn't realize the sort of compression that you have going through the corner for starters, but also just seeing old school Formula One curbs was quite cool. Curbs now are just sort of, they're either sausage curbs or they're quite flat with AstroTurf on the other side, and it's just easy to just run over them basically. And actually seeing like the old sort of looking quite rustic, shall we say, curbs, just, you know, it's like that's like one of the classic forgotten corners. Well, not forgotten because everyone loves it and wants it back, but one of the old not in use corners anymore of Formula One. So there was quite a lot of people that were being realistic as well. Mugello, Algarve, all circuits that are actually being suggested, a couple of advocations for Brands Hatch as well, and also a couple of advocations for the Circuit de la Sarthe. But unfortunately, the full Le Mans circuit isn't grade one, is it? It's grade two, I think.
Yeah, that you're not going to be able to a Grand Prix there. And in fact, the one time there was a World Championship race at Le Mans, which was in 67, it was on the Bugatti circuit, which really didn't go down very well with people.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that. So yeah, that... A very, very healthy smattering of responses from the sane and quiet fever to the absolutely mental. So as I've done with a few of these before, I'm now going to throw the questions to you. So for the pair of you, I'll start with you, Ed, because I know you like being put on the spot. What would you have as the bonus European venue? Let's say has to have an element of logic and realism to it, but doesn't have to be restricted to the three or four circuits that we know are 100% having conversations.
Well, I'm going to stick with Manicor as my sensible suggestion. Try and rebuild the reputation of that track. You know, nice combination of corners, some quick stuff, good car challenge, great overtaking spot in the Adelaide hairpin. Often created good races, actually. So I think it got a rather unfair reputation, as Mark alluded to. Can I just throw in a mad suggestion as well, because I like mentioning this circuit? I'd like to see a return to Solitude in Germany. It's near Stuttgart, kind of a Nürburgring-esque one. Just a proper old school, extremely dangerous sort of foresty, undulating road course. Just that would be my mad venue to return to. It never hosted a world championship race. Did host Formula One races. In fact, a Brabham F1 car, I think, got their first win there in 63, probably. So got some history. Great place to go.
Brilliant. I love that. That's brilliant. Mark, have you got a logical and a mad suggestion?
My mad suggestion, I'd agree with your reader, but Clermont-Ferrand. And if you go on to YouTube, there's a guy who's taking footage of it as it is now from his car on his car phone, and it's just fantastic. It's awesome. So he even like takes you through the gated off bits and shows you where the circuit is now being reclaimed by nature, and then just walks through that bit, and then he'll take you, show you where it comes out, and then continue onwards. And then if you watch that, and then there's some black and white footage of the 72 Grand Prix from there, and it's amazing. It's absolutely incredible that even as recently as 1972, which I know is a long time ago, but it just seems bizarre that it could even be as recent as that the Grand Prix was actually held there. In terms of a modern, realistic track, yeah, Istanbul Park for me, the magnificent track. We heard about, you know, the big challenge of Turn 8, which was that like oval like very, very fast left hander that would had about three apexes, and that was fantastic. But the whole track was, and it had undulation, had different sections that were demanded different things of the car and the driver. And I think that was just a wonderful track, really. Not ideally placed geographically. That would count against it now. But of all the tracks that we've lost in recent years, that's the one I think has lost us the most.
Can we add Rouen to make a nice French doubleheader with Clermont-Ferrand? I think that would be fun. That was another classic circuit. And that was used, I think they were still holding F3 races there as recently as the early 90s, maybe 92, that sort of time they were still using it. So most of the tracks still there in theory, all public roads. Great fun.
Yeah. My suggestion for a slightly mad one would be the first track I think I ever drove on a racing game, and therefore it's always had a special place in my heart, which is Dijon.
Mm. Yeah, unusual choice, but yeah.
I don't know why. I think if I saw it now in reality or saw F1 on there, I think I'd probably be underwhelmed, because as a kid seeing that track and playing it on a video game, and then obviously seeing some of the famous clips from history around there, it's got like it's got the track equivalent of godlike status in my head, and I fear that the reality would actually be quite underwhelming. But I'd just like to see it because I've always quite liked it. And from a realistic point of view, I mean, I know I said Mugello earlier when it came to sort of what I'd like to see from the tracks that they're actually talking about. Part of me would just, if I could go there and actually see it firsthand, it would be Imola. It's interesting that it actually seems to be in the conversation. It's a track I've always wanted to go to and never been able to. So that would be quite a good pick.
Yeah, Imola's a great place. It's dropped out of Formula One just before I started covering it, but I have been there, and it's cracking place to go. I think we've got some good plans there. So just a nice mixture of mad circuits and realistic circuits.
Should we just submit this section of the podcast to Ross Brawn and Chase Carey and just say, here you go, here's the rest of your season?
Yeah, it's solved all the problems and utterly realistic as well. Easy. Well, thanks very much for that, Scott. Are you setting a new Scots people question for next week, or are you going to ask for more suggestions, or do you have some other master plan?
I don't have a I never have a master plan. I would like to I would like to take this one step further into the surreal and go just no restrictions whatsoever. What's the sort of wackiest place to have your Formula One race? I've had a couple of suggestions already because I've had a couple of people advocating Brands Indy.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. We could go back to Arvus with the extreme banking corners as well. That'd be fun.
But not close it to public traffic.
That would spice things up a bit, wouldn't it? That's only mildly more unrealistic than holding a Grand Prix on the closed circuit, to be quite honest. So, yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Exactly. So there you go. There's the question for the next edition of Scots People. We turn this week's question into the realms of insanity and full-on creativity. So if you've got one circuit, where would it be? And I'm going to start off with Cadwell Park. So if anyone else can pick that up, I'll throw the question out on Twitter as well. We can see what madness it brings.
Well, we get in the under 2 litre, because there's a 2 litre cap, isn't there, on the Cadwell Park for single seats or something. I can't remember the exact rule. But yeah, that's a very narrow circuit. So that would be an interesting one. Undulating, to say the least. Yeah, I approve of that one. So thank you very much, Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Hopefully we've come up with some sensible insight as well as some mad ideas in that podcast. Do head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen. Loads on the latest in the world of Formula One. The calendar continues to evolve, so plenty to delve into there. Check out our YouTube channel as well. Search for The Race. Loads of videos cropping up there on F1 Matters, both current and retrospective, so lots there. And of course, we've got other podcasts, the Gary Anderson F1 Show, eSport Podcast, Formula E Podcast, plenty to listen to there. And of course, Bring Back V10, which revisits classic F1 stories. Our first series is there to listen to. And we have had a second season commissioned, so there'll be more of those podcasts coming up. Thanks for listening. We're off to familiarise ourselves with the 18,000 words of FIA documents about how motor racing will be held, and we will see how that will affect future editions of the podcast.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.